Hey everyone, Casey Cangelosi here. Welcome to episode 149 of At Percussion. This episode will be another one of my roundtable discussion episodes. We recorded this on June 2nd, 2018 at the first ever Tocolo Tucson Percussion Festival. Morris Palter has done wonders for the contemporary percussion solo repertoire and has been a huge advocate for new music as a performing soloist and chamber percussionist. We had Morris as a percussion guest back on episode 102 if you'd like to hear more about and from Morris. Bill Kahn, of course, has had a long-standing symphonic career, but he is also a founding member of literally the most historic percussion ensemble, the Nexus Percussion Group. Also in the room is Jacob Ransom, Tiffany Johnson, and Michael Pratt. Huge thanks to all three of them, Jacob, Michael, Tiffany, and of course Morris, for having me out as a guest artist and putting together just a great percussion festival there in Tucson. So stay tuned for next week. Our guest will be Drew Tucker, and as a reminder, you can catch us on all the usual places: Blogspot, iTunes, Stitcher, and YouTube. So, okay, thanks everyone. Enjoy.
Come back down. This
the Canadians.
No, I have been impressed with what I've seen so far. Hey, well, you know, why don't we just go around the room real quick so people can match a name to a voice? I'm, of course, Casey Cangelosi. Right here is...
I'm Jake Ransom.
And...
Morris Palter.
And...
Tiffany Johnson.
So you guys get it.
It's easy.
Michael Pratt.
And Bill Kahn.
Whoa.
Ooh, what? Can you say that name again?
Wait, this is fake news.
Yeah.
That could be anybody. That could just be someone we found.
I think it's someone from So Percussions anyway.
I don't doubt it. Yeah. Hey, well, so look, Morris is the host. We're here at Tocolo Tucson. And I don't know what Tocolo means.
Well, Tocolo really doesn't have an official meaning in the sense of toka is to, or tokar is to play. So Tocolo is really just sort of a play on that, sort of a slang thing of like playing stuff.
Play it, really. I
play
mean,
it.
It's like play it, you know, and
like hit
a
it,
command,
like
play, right?
Yeah,
play
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
Right.
Did you go through other names? Was it tough? Was choosing a name tough?
Yeah, we thought like... Hit Stuff Festival. I knew I wanted something like a reference to this part of the world in the sense that we're right on the border of Mexico, a lot of Spanish speaking. We're here in Arizona and sort of speaking to that sort of environment of speaking to where we are in the world. I had the percussion ensemble up in Alaska, and I named that Ensemble 64.8, 64.8 being the latitude of Fairbanks, Alaska. So it's like trying to resonate a little bit somewhat with where you are in the world. And, you know, you're always trying to come up with some sort of interesting name for the, you know what I mean? Like when
something
you're trying to, yeah, right. Something catches some attention to it. And hopefully down the road, it can just be known as like Tocolo Tucson and people will know it's a percussion festival. And that's what we do right now. It's the Tocolo Tucson Summer Chamber Percussion. You know what I mean? It's like, you sort of got to get that out, but eventually it should just be like, oh, I'm going to Tocolo Tucson and people will know what that is.
With all the amazing, like I can think of 130 excellent summer percussion festivals to go to, what made you think, yeah, now's the time to like add another one?
Right. Well, that's an excellent question, Casey. This is why you do this.
This is the real news.
This is the real news.
Yeah, we asked the hard questions.
You know, I think what it was that there was really nothing like that. You know, not that that is all that unique, but there's nothing going on of this sort of thing in really, you know, southwestern U.S. So, there was nothing going on like that in New Mexico or like this in New Mexico. There was nothing in Arizona. I'm sure there's some things in California, but like Southern California, you know, me being a UC San Diego, you know, alumni, there's nothing going on there. You know what I mean? Like it's,
yeah.
So I just thought it's sort of, there's a void, you know, people who are on this side of the US, most of the things that I'm familiar with anyways, happening on the East Coast, and I thought, well, it'd be good to have something in sort of the Southwest that, you know, you could just come out and check.
Bill, do you want to tell us a little about history of Nexus and improvisation? You did a great improvisation class today, and I'd love to just hear a little about I know you've been doing that for a long time. Nexus has a long history with improvisation, but I don't know the history.
Okay, well, it was of necessity. When Nexus formed, all of us were, and you're going to hear this tomorrow in our workshop, but all of us were classically trained. And we all love classical music, but for percussionists, you know, you sit there for the first three movements, and in the finale, you play a couple of triangle notes or a cymbal crash. And that's great because you love the music. But we wanted to explore other possibilities, all of us. And all of us came from the same sensibility of music making, which was the Philadelphia Orchestra's concept, in which sound itself is a very important factor, maybe the most important factor. So we were all of a like mind about what sounds great. And there were other factors at work at the time we formed were the budding of globalization. Prior to our being through college, you couldn't hear music from Indonesia. You couldn't hear live musicians performing from, Ivory Coast in Africa. But after that, there were three things. After we were students, all at the same time we were thinking about forming an ensemble, there were three processes at work. One was hi-fi recording, which gave good quality recordings of musics of other cultures as well as our own culture. Preceding recordings, the sound spectrum was that much, was a very narrow sound spectrum. Hi-fi broadened it and made recording much more accessible to percussion instruments, which was our focus. Second thing was jet travel. Prior to Nexus forming, I remember we did a wind ensemble tour on a DC-6 of the United States, and it took 12 hours for us to get from here to from our house in Rochester to Chicago on a DC-6,
wow.
Right? So jet travel meant that you could have breakfast in New York and dinner in LA. In fact, maybe even lunch in LA.
Right.
You could have breakfast in London and have dinner in New York or even Rochester later on. So travel, the travel made it possible for us to go to other places to hear music in its context. And it also made it possible for musicians in other places to come to us, and which happened. There was for the first time ever an ethnic art series, and music schools became interested in taking advantage of that. So they hired teachers from other cultures, for example, Wesleyan University, where Bob and Russell went to study African music, Indonesian music, Japanese music, and so forth. The third factor was international trade. Jets and now cargo ships, which this is all new after we were out of college, these big container ships, made it possible for you to have access to instruments. So when Nexus first formed, Bob and I would get in a car and we would drive all over the eastern United States going into antique shops and trying to buy bells, gongs, and exotic instruments that we knew nothing about. We just find them and, oh, that's cool sound, let's buy that. And they were cheap because nobody else wanted them, you know? So we acquired instruments that way. But after international trade became an easier thing, you could start acquiring things directly from the source. And today, I mean, you just Google your whatever you want anywhere in the world, and there's a distributor somewhere, you Google them and you have it 2 days later. Right. So that, and you pay for it though, however. Yeah. So everything that we got in our collection, that fascinated us because these were from other cultures that we knew nothing about. And just knowing nothing about them was exciting. We didn't have any of the baggage that comes with studying in the foreign cultures. There are other levels of commitment that you have to make to have access to these things. But these were in antique shops, and we were able to acquire these things and explore them on our own. So our first concert was getting all of this stuff that we had bought over the years and experimented one at a time with each of us, but putting them all on the stage in Kilburn Hall at the Eastman School of Music. And we didn't have the money to hire a composer. And if we had the money to hire a composer, nobody would have known what to do unless they came and lived with us and explored these instruments. So this is all necessity, but taking advantage of a situation that's new in the world, all right? And we just happened to be there at that time, just luck or whatever. So we filled the stage with these instruments, and because we couldn't commission a composer, and we didn't, there was just no way to do it anyway, we just decided, well, let's go out and improvise, which we had been doing on our own, not as Nexus, but Bob and I together. Maybe I'd get together with John Wire. Bob would get together with Robin or something, and we would just improvise. So the concert began. The four of us, Russell was not yet in the group, although he would be with us in the second concert. The four of us improvised a one-hour piece for the first half of the concert. We walked off stage, the audience trying to figure out what had just happened, and us trying to figure out, well, what was that all about? And did it work or not work? And we felt really good about what had happened. In fact, I have a good recording of that first performance was recorded. So we went back, did another improvisation for another hour. And the reviewer, the music reviewer in Rochester, which had a major music reviewer and music section in the main newspaper, was at that concert. He gave us a rave review. For a lot of reasons, he got it, and he was able to find something of value in it. So, let's do this again, guys.
Is that the same guy that said there's no way this could have possibly been?
No. That's already two decades later, you know.
Oh, okay.
Or maybe 3 decades later. So improvisation was the only way to explore these instruments practically. There was no really other way to get into them. And eventually, we started composing pieces for us, knowing a little bit about these pieces and what these instruments and what their possibilities were, and trying to create pieces that were semi-composed sometimes, had improvisatory elements to it, but there were certain specific things that the composer had in mind, Bob or John Wire or even Robin, myself, and even Russell when we started out. So the improvisation was done by nature. So over the years that followed that first concert, well, for the first 5 years, all of our concerts were completely improvised. One day Bob came in and played Rainbow Ripples for us and made an arrangement for the five of us and said, guys, let's try this. And we thought it would be good to put it at the end of an improvisation. So we were playing with a Hamilton Philharmonic, and it was a great program format. The orchestra played a couple of contemporary pieces. The orchestra left the stage. We had our setup, which was a huge setup of gongs and bells and drums, none of them traditional Western instruments. We improvised a piece, but we thought it would be cool to end this piece with Rainbow Ripples. So the improvisation just led into Rainbow Ripples, and the audience freaked after they heard Rainbow. And wow, this is pretty good. Maybe we should do some more of this, you know. So,
sure.
So that was the second thing. Then the African music that Bob and Russell learned, we all spent some time down at Wesleyan University with Abraham and Zenya picking up that stuff. And so the repertoire grew. Robin brought the third construction in. We had not a clue what that piece was all about, and it looked very complex. And it was very hard to come to the point where we all felt it would be worthy of a commitment that it was going to take to get it to happen in terms of rehearsal, practice time, finding instruments. That was a big deal, getting the right instruments for each player. And we all had our own choices, but we also all were subject to the input of the other players on our instrument selections. So that repertoire got into our music. But all the while, we still did improvisations on our concerts. All right, and we gave titles to these improvisations and registered them with ASCAP and so forth. All right, so we would go to a college, and the college was, we would offer workshops, and the colleges and music schools were interested in this improvisation stuff, thinking it's going to be jazz. And we were going in another direction that even some of the jazzers had not able to buy into, you know. So, but improvisation was always the element, and even playing the cage or playing any of the other music we played, improvisation was a factor. The mentality of improvising and the process of improvising heavily influenced all of the music we played. We started doing stuff with orchestras, composing our own pieces. We hadn't yet commissioned other composers, but that soon happened afterwards. Still keeping improvisatory aspects into the compositions. We almost always had cadenzas that we improvised. We would ask the composer to do that. Our typical improvisation, I'm talking for a very long time. So, so the typical improvisation.
I asked for the history.
Yeah. And, well, I was born in. So the typical improvisation workshop that Nexus would do was we would set up our weird stuff. We would improvise for 5 minutes, finish the piece, and then invite the audience to talk about it, and then have some volunteers from the percussion department or even non-percussionists come up and play for a couple of minutes with our instruments, and then we'd talk about that. Then we'd go with our stuff and leave the percussionists at the university with, okay, that was good, but now what do we do? You know, there was no pedagogy involved. There was simply providing an experience. So late 1990s, John and I were invited by the Eastman School to do a summer session in improvisation. And that's when I started to think about pedagogy. And the pedagogy was simply, how did we do this, get where we are? What did we do in our formative years? And those are the four steps. We recorded into reel-to-reel tape recorders. We listened to them back. We laughed. We cried. We high-fived and gave each other ugly looks, you know, and reacted to what we were doing. But we had we gave ourselves our own feedback. And this pedagogy developed. It started to be productive, and it was being effective with classical musicians. I started doing, and John both and I started doing improvisation workshops for symphony orchestras. And that's a whole, I could talk all night about that experience and the beauty of it with people who never had the opportunity to improvise because they thought of improvisation as jazz, and they knew that there's a lot of baggage to improvise in jazz, and they rightly thought that they couldn't do anything that would be accepted by either the colleagues or the audience. This pedagogy I put together into a book. And although Nexus was still doing its thing, and here we are today, and 13, 14 years after the book was written, here we are doing pedagogy for percussionists at the University of Arizona. And next week I'll be doing it for high school kids at the Eastman School. And it's worldwide, there's interest in it. Educators at all levels are interested in what improvisation is, and this is a good way to find out about that, and not only in music, but realizing that almost everything you do in life, in fact, I would say everything has an improvisatory nature to it.
Sure. Well, I don't know how you guys felt about today, but I've been to free improvisation clinics before and had similar settings. And it's just great to see one more professional have such a free attitude about it. And like, yeah, that's right. It's not jazz. That's right. I don't have to be in a groove. I don't have to like always know what the chord changes are, et cetera, and so on. It was like very liberating and helpful to see that, you know?
I want to say it's liberating and it's freeing, but it's also, I feel like getting up to that point, it's almost sort of frustrating at first. Like for me personally, because I knew going into it that I like organized things. I like having a set structure and instructions to follow. But being conscious and being aware of the fact that this is frustrating at first, but delving into it, you know, that to me was the whole point of the exercises to get to that point and to have that sort of inner battle of breaking free of any sort of conceptualization you might have of, well, how do I improv, or what do people think of me, what do I think of me, you know, getting rid of that critical mindset and just kind of having fun and just appreciating the experience for what it is. To me it's a battle. It's hard work getting to that, but it's also kind of I don't know. To me, it was hard at first, but once you get into that point, it's very liberating, I think.
Well, if you had any reservations about it, you should see the reservations that the string players in the symphony orchestra have about doing this, okay? Yeah. And you should see the look on their faces when they listen to the playback and realize how incredibly well they're able to use their background and their knowledge of the instrument in just doing something right on the moment, spur of the moment, and being free of having being judged about what they're doing. Mm-hmm. All right, that is a very liberating thing, to be free of judgmental concerns.
Yeah, I was thinking about it, and I kind of had this idea that I want to get to the place where I can make the music that I hear. And I was just thinking about that while we were improvising, or like even after the fact. And I was like, if I could go back and tell myself something and say, play the music that I want to hear or that I am hearing, rather than even having any reservation about it, just kind of let it out, because we're all listening to each other and I'm listening to everybody else, but I also have a factor in what's going on. And I think that's kind of an important thing about it too, is that you have a voice and it's important to use it.
I could comment on that I think the more you do this, the more that process reverses.
Yeah.
You don't hear what you want to play.
Oh.
You play first and then hear that and then go with that. All right, you lay your ideas out, whatever it is, and it could be good. It's not a good or bad idea, it's an idea. There it is, and okay, what do we do now? And work with that. So it sort of works the other way. Although, the more you do this, and the more you have confidence in your instrument, and the more you have the experience of doing this in the past and making music in other areas, other genres, you know what's going to happen to a certain extent before you lay that down. I would say 90%, maybe 80% of what's going on, but there's always a percentage where you don't know how that's going to fit with everybody else. Mm-hmm. And that's always interesting.
Yeah.
Because you have to then deal with it and make it work.
So, I think a lot of what we're talking about is ego, and how your ego factors in to the improvisational process of your ego is the thing that questions, what am I doing? How am I doing it? Like, it's gotta be good. I'll hate my, it's such a predominant force in our life, our own ego, that you're stepping up into this thing, which is foreign territory to a lot of people, and being accepting of whatever happens, I think it's difficult. I think it's difficult in life to be accepting.
This is a heavy life lesson.
Of what happens,
absolutely.
Right? Like, be accepting of your decisions. Like, you might think about, or I might think about a decision for a long time before I do it, and then still maybe regret it, in the sense that, not that you should regret your decisions because you're doing the thing that you think is, it's like when you talk about that student that didn't play for like 5 minutes, I think it's because they just didn't want to regret maybe what...
Oh, absolutely.
They didn't want to regret what they did.
Of course.
Like, this is the moment. This is like, and then it boils down to like, I just got to do something, And I think that's always the thing that I'm challenged with in those situations, because even though improvisation exists on a drum set, I'm more familiar with that world. Even though improvisation exists in ragtime, I'm much more familiar with the confines of what, I don't want to be an improviser of like what someone would play in 1960 when I'm playing, like on a vibraphone, when I'm playing a tune from the 1920s. So I'm like, I'm not going to do that kind of improvising.
It's idiomatic improvisation.
In that improvisation.
Right.
But when it's like there are no rules, that is scary.
Of course.
When there's no rules, it's really scary.
Of course.
Yeah.
When there are rules, it's scary.
You mentioned ego. Tiffany's ego.
My ego was in check when I tried to sell drums to someone. Someone said, "I'm glad I didn't spend 5 years getting a doctorate degree and selling drums out of my garage." And like that firmly.
So you guys, I thought I knew Morris pretty well, but I have no idea. Yes, like black market it's Rogers business. Drum
yeah.
flipping.
Easy,
business.
Yeah. What's not? No, I'm just kidding.
I've seen him on the podcast now.
Yeah,
it's like advertising, man.
Yeah, right.
Oh, yeah.
Come talk to me.
Yeah.
So what's that model? He got me into it, actually.
Yeah, I got him into it. He made some very cool
Pacific drums, PDP.
Addicted now.
Yeah,
I
was able to make
$200.
No, I did not. I pointed him in the right direction.
Took advantage. I refurbished, put new heads, and made $300.
So I've seen more Rogers drums in the last 2 days than I've ever seen. I'm serious. My teacher had a Rogers kit. You know, we've got some odds and ends at JMU that I see floating around. We do have a Rogers kit there. Laurel's dad has a Rogers kit. I think the same one my teacher from when I was a little kid has. But, like, where are you getting all these Rogers drums, man?
I cannot share on my podcast.
Well, you know where to get it if you ever need it.
No, I mean, in all honesty, how this whole thing got started was when I was in grad school and I needed to pay rent. I had no money, you know, and I was a lecturer. I mean, I graduated in, you know, I'm sure anyone who's listening to this who's in school and then not in school and
no
sort of on that, yeah, no one's actually listening to this, but when you're a TA, I actually made more money as a TA than I did as a lecturer at the university because I didn't get health benefits as a lecturer, and the take home was about the same. So I then had to pay for my. So I just started buying drums that I would find on Craigslist and refurbishing them, anything, any kind of drums, right? Fixing them up, like the sort of the more beat up, the better, because then I could, you know, invest not a lot of money and make much more money when you, you know, sorted them out. And so that's where I started. And then along the way, like every 20th time you show up at someone's house, they're like, well, yeah, I hear you bought this crappy Tama Rockstar kit, but I've got this thing my grandfather had that I just don't really care about. And it's like, oh, Slingerland Radio Cane snare drum.
Yeah.
You know, and they're just like, well, give me $100 and you can have that too, right?
Dude,
and so you do that.
Tama,
oh, sorry. But anyways, that's back in the day. I mean, Tama was making great kits, the early superstars.
There we go.
That was Stuart Copeland's drum set of choice. Right, right. Honest, straight up, those were great, great drums. So you just sort of accumulating all this gear, and then you keep them, and then you fall in love with stuff, and you wouldn't want to sell it, and then that stuff just stayed with me. And that's when I first accumulated some Rogers things. And then here I met a guy in town. It was an old music shop that closed down and got rid of all their stuff, and I sent it to this guy, and then this guy's been sort of really good and just going hanging out. I've told all my students about them. Anytime I come over, no one's taking me up on it. I mean, it's one of those things where it's right there for the pickings.
Like,
but
it sounds like work.
It is a lot of work. I mean, it really is.
You want to polish this rusty hepatitis hi-hat?
Yeah.
They get you a tetanus shot.
Right. There is. That's a new song that they do.
Inventory is, you know, somebody's wife says, like, I'm tired of this.
Right, seriously.
Like, get rid of this. Like, I'm tired of seeing this. Like, you never play this. Let me, I don't want to see it anymore.
Right.
And
well,
then, you know, it becomes, you know, a good business opportunity for us.
Are you
going
to work as a team?
Oh, yeah.
You guys
Tiffany,
work together.
I'm telling you, Tiffany can date Roger's stuff better than anyone in this room. Like, she's got superpowers. Like, she can program, you know, Mallet cats and drum cats, and she can date Roger's stuff because it's everywhere. You know, you don't see it now, but it's like rats in the walls. There's Roger's stuff everywhere.
Hopefully, don't tell them about all the movie posters.
I see the odds and ends, and even just being here, like that hi hat clutch. It's like, yeah, we have one of those clutches.
Yeah, it's a
$50
clutch.
I have no idea why.
It's sort of just spawned from that. It came out of literally, I have to pay rent when I was a grad student. And then I just loved working with my hands. Like, I love fixing stuff. Like, I love fixing stuff. So I love getting a drum that's like a snare drum that's missing half its stuff and beat up and no one's loved it in 30 years.
Yeah.
And you bring it back to life and you hit it. It's just like, oh my God, like, this is an incredible sounding instrument. Like, it truly is. And it's like, wow, this thing just laid waste forever. And it's like, I'm so happy that I've got this thing now that I make music on.
So I talked to you guys a little about this earlier, but for Tiffany, was there a tipping point where you're like, this isn't a good idea, this is taking up so much space, these drums are filthy, this and then, because now you're really into it.
You know, it's true. You know, I think, you did set some ground rules in the kitchen, like. This is actually pretty good. This is really tame.
We got three or four at a time in this area alone stacked up. So,
but
it's fun and it's very fun
to just see watch.
No, but in all honesty, I just sold a drum set. I've told you this maybe a month ago now, and I refurbished it. It was an old Rogers White, New England white kit. And this kid came over and he was just like, can I come check it out? I was just like, oh yeah, I want it. It's just like, Joe, the Ramones drummer's kid used the Rogers, this white New England kid. And Buddy Rich played Rogers early on. And he was just like, I want it. He's probably like in his late 20s maybe. And his girlfriend or wife was here with him. And she was just like so happy that he was happy. He's just like, but I've only got $500 now. Can I pay you the rest? On Monday, I got to work on the weekend. I was like, yeah, sure, of course, no problem. And you're giving me $500 to leave my house without any stuff. Like, I can do that all day long as far as I'm concerned. And he called me like an hour later. It's just like, man, I just need to have that thing tonight. I got to play it tonight. Like, I got the money from my parents and I just want to come back and get it. And he came back and he got it. And then he like texted me photos of him at home playing this thing. And it's like, I never thought I'd have a vintage drum kit like this. Like, it's just so awesome. And he was so happy. And I just thought, man, like, this is who this stuff should get. And meanwhile, that exact same kit took me like 2 months to put it all back together and find the parts and do this thing. And it was all laid to waste. And now it's like alive again. And like, I almost feel like that drum kit's happy. It's just like, thank you. I'm being played now. Like, this is where I'm supposed to be.
It's like Toy Story for drums.
Right, Toy Story for drums, right? Like, this is what I'm supposed to happen. I'm supposed to be played, I'm an instrument, And so everyone wins. And I don't want anyone to think that I'm like, making thousands and thousands of dollars here, because that's not the case. It's like, you might make $300 or $400 on that, but you might invest hours and hours of your time putting that thing into it.
Yeah.
But ultimately, it's like, that is so great that he has that thing, because I don't need that kit, right? Like, I've got enough stuff, like, I don't need it. And I wasn't playing it.
Yeah.
So it's like, now I know this kid is like loving this thing. And that's really like the thing that really makes you happy. Like, when you're selling that part, that the one guy, I'll get contacted all the time. Like, I just need this one part to put my Rogers kit back together again. It's like, I got it. It's like, awesome. And they're like, before anything, they sent you like, how much, name your price. And then PayPal is sent like 30 seconds later. And they're like, when can I get it? It's like, I'll ship it out tomorrow. Like, and it might just be like a lug or a leg for a bass drum, but they're missing one of the legs, and they're just so stoked to have this thing again that, like, and that's, I think, really, because in terms of, you really boil it down to cost benefit of money and time, it's a losing proposition.
Sure.
It just is.
A lot of time.
Like, occasionally you might stumble upon something that's worth a ton of money. But when you add up all the other stuff you've had to do to get to I got that one thing super cheap that's worth a lot.
But I mean, we can all think of 1,000 recreational activities that would cost way more money than you wouldn't make a cent doing.
Right.
The fact that you guys enjoy doing
I've probably refurbished 15 to 20 bass drum hoops alone that have like an inlay strip of old Ludwig and Rogers and Slingerland ones. And I just love doing it.
Have you ever thought about giving a refurbishing workshop? Like, you bring in an old drum, you bring in a know.
Yeah, I mean,
sandpaper.
I should. I would be into it. I just wonder if other people would really be into it.
Do you guys?
That's the thing. Like, I just don't know.
This is a question for Michael and Jake now.
Yeah.
I'm trying to put them on the spot about it.
Does that sound more appealing than like a slap together polyrhythm?
Ouch. A need for not just percussionists to go to that, but any high school or middle school band director who has this treasure trove of rundown equipment. The thing you would have to do is you have to make it practical and make it
right.
Obviously, like I would, and I mean this very respectfully, I feel like you would get a snare drum and you just kind of go into it and start digging into it, and everybody else would be kind of left in the dust. You know, start putting everything together.
Yeah,
but it's
like,
great.
Exactly,
exactly. So maybe like take the standard, so you know, a bass drum, you have a cymbal that's cracked, or you know, something that you
right.
find in a middle school
right.
setting. And
it'd
then.
Be right, and sort that out.
Yeah, I honestly, I think that'd be a fabulous clinic.
I
think
like,
it'd be a fabulous method book.
I feel like there's less need for learning how to refurbish a vintage Ludwig bass drum hoop with its inlay strip than there is to tuck calf heads on a snare drum, and tucking calf heads on snare drums is already sort of something that's gone by the way. Like, how many people run across the need to know how to refurbish a bass drum hoop on a vintage Ludwig drum set? I mean, like, that's the problem with it, is that I just got into it, but, you know, you know, like, really, like, I don't know.
So,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead.
I was gonna say, like, maybe even having a reference guide.
Right.
For, like, maybe on your website or something, say a middle school band director walks in, they're like, I don't know what this is, like
right.
this old junky thing that's left over from 20 years ago.
Right.
Oh, it's got these kind of lugs on it, you know, like, where do I go to find that out, right?
Right.
I'm
it's
sure
funny.
There are things, but
it is,
you go to your website, you can tell
I know.
You're
it is,
so
no, it's funny to say that, because on social media, on Facebook, on like there's like a Rogers thing, a Ludwig thing, like if you actually go, like there's anything of all these things,
yeah.
right? And someone posted something about like, hey, I've got these old bass drum hoops of Ludwig stuff, like how do I refurbish these things and photos of it? And people, you can see all these comments, and I'm reading these things going like, absolutely, like, you and I wrote like a chapter of what this guy needs to do. Like, you use a steak knife to pry out the staple on the hoop, because all of them have staples, and you keep the staples, don't lose them, because they go and they're super deep, and then you use something to like slide the inlay strip, because you just try to pull the inlay strip off, it's gonna snap, because they're super, so you got like, you know, because people are just like, oh, just like pull this off and do this and
yeah.
do that, and I'm like, no, they need, like, you have to sand, like, you have to do this, and when you spray paint it, make sure the flat, because all hoops have a curved edge and a flat edge, and make sure the flat edge is down when you spray paint. I got deep into it, and all these comments that happened were just like, dude, you need help, you know? And others were just like, this is awesome, like, thank you, like, this is, I had no idea, this is how you actually do this.
So
but like, it was also just like, get a life, you know? And I was like, the actual
I want to see a podcast in the future.
So I'm going to ask Bill,
yeah.
who in Nexus is currently or was the most like Morris in this regard? Because I feel like percussionists, you can pretty much see that one's a gearhead, this
right.
one's not. Like, you know, I think I'm not nearly the gearhead. I'm like, you know, further left on the spectrum.
Right.
It's like,
right.
oh man, this drum isn't working. Oh, just get it away from me. Like, I know, it's terrible. It's like, yeah, terrible. Oh, my head is gone. Screw it.
Right.
My head's out of tune. Give me a new drum. But anyway, who do you think is?
I think Robin was generally interested in that. Russell was not interested in that aspect of the field.
Mm.
And Bob really was not interested in that. He was
good.
Interested in the quality of instruments.
See, I'm right, Bob.
Yeah.
yeah.
Like kindred spirit.
Right.
Bob.
You're like, yeah,
Bob.
You're
Bob and I'm Bob.
Yeah, right.
But I've got a question for you.
Like, oh, no.
Because
yeah.
Your piece the piece that we rehearsed the first day, Theatric 11.
Yeah.
So when I was a student, there was no such thing as what I would call theatrics in performance, in percussion, in fact, in any aspect of musical performance. There really wasn't. Now, that's resonating worldwide.
Yeah.
What can you say about where does that come from, and how does it connect with these guys who are studying here at the University of Arizona?
Man,
what's in it for them? And there's a lot in it, I believe, this is your thing, man.
Yeah.
So what is it that's causing that to resonate worldwide? Do you have a sense of that? Because Globacars, Corporelle, and they're now a whole host of pieces that the students are really interested in. Some of them explore percussion instruments with a bunch of what we would call non-musical elements, but they are musical because they're part of the piece, but not traditionally so. So anyway, that's the question.
I think it's back to what we were talking about yesterday. I mean, music in its purest form is very difficult. You know, you want to describe something, like here on the table is crackers and cheese that we've all been sharing. It's like, oh, you want to describe crackers and cheese with a painting. It's very easy. You draw it, you paint it. It's like way simple. You want to describe it with literature. You write crackers and cheese, done. It's like, those art forms are so good at that. How music describes crackers and cheese is almost impossible, you know, unless you like are actually show the audience crackers and cheese, you know what I'm saying? So I wonder if that part of the interest might be that the visual assistance makes it easier.
Well, what you're describing is like there's a whole level of like unpredictability in this music that you're composing. And with people being able to access, you know, anything on, you know, YouTube or Spotify or whatever, you know, there's gotta be some added value in going to like a live performance of music. And if people can just go and see what they saw on YouTube, or they can hear, you know, what they hear all the time, you know, it's not the same value. But when you add this level of like unpredictability to a music performance, it creates an excitement or anticipation for people that they don't have with just, you know, their computers or iPads, you know.
Yeah, right. There is something really exciting when you see a musician turn the page and you can tell, like, oh, they're missing a page, and they freak out, they keep playing, you know, all of a sudden, what are they going to do? How are they going to get through this one, you know? Yeah, no, I think you're exactly right, but I don't know, what do you guys think? Like, you're the youngest dudes in the room. I mean, you know, you've seen pieces like Aphasia and Silence Must Be, like, they're literally theatrical, you know? I don't know, what do you guys think? I honestly think it's, I feel like I've seen it coming, and I almost feel like it's already, you know, people are like, okay, that's a thing, you know? But I remember, I don't know, a few years ago, I heard comments from students saying, like, this is the future, this is how it's gonna be, everything's gonna be like this. Like, dude, no, it's not. It's gonna be like, good, we have this pool, just like we have vibe solos, we have multi-percussion solos, we have snare drum solos, this is another one. I mean, that's what I think. And that's what I've observed. But what do you guys think?
So going to the original question, do I think that this sort of theatric presentation of, like, were y'all calling it percussion? Like, is it in a new field of, like, percussion solo repertoire? Or
I don't know. My theatric.
It's not really, some of them are not really written for percussionists, right? Like, some of them, but how the percussionists have adopted it in that?
Percussionists are in the catch-all, though. There's something interesting to play, like leave
it
to the percussionists.
Give it to
the
percussionists,
Like, okay, we'll figure it out.
Yeah.
So, I think it is part of the repertoire.
I always thought that maybe it connects with percussionists because so much of what we do is already has sort of that, I don't know exactly how to describe it, but a very visual component that doesn't, not just aesthetically pleasing, but also creates more of an attention. Like, so for instance, if I play this kind of stroke, and nobody can see it, but if I'm like waving, loose whipping motion by the arm, you know, people are gonna think long stroke, like, or long legato stroke, right? Or if I play really sharp and intense it's staccato. But if I do it on a snare drum, it's just dap. Like, that's what you hear, right? And so there's this illusion that even though what I'm hearing, it may not actually be different, but I'm intentionally creating something visually to give the impression that here's a long stroke, or I'm making articulation, or I'm giving shape to a line.
There have been studies that it's true. You do listen with your eyes.
Yes, and it's in the new Russell Hardenberger.
Yeah.
The Oxford Companion, right?
Yeah, yeah.
The Companion, the Cambridge, right? Okay. I forget my friend. That does its study, and they actually took Michael Bird on the marimba and measured
Michael,
like,
Schultz, that's his.
Yes.
He was one of our guests on an episode.
Yeah, but
he walks us through it.
And so to me, like, maybe percussionists respond to this so positively because it's such a innate, natural thing that we do already. Least some of the best, the best ones, but, you know,
yeah.
We think about the music that way because we're, I don't know, maybe it's just because we have to find new ways to phrase on an instrument that is just monotone, or not monotone, but monotimbral, or you know, doesn't have harmony or melody or anything like that. It's just a tap sound, and so we've had to sort of maybe add a little theatrics to that to make it more impressionable or make it more exciting in that sense. So maybe that, this is just a theory. I've actually never, I was never introduced to any pieces like this until I came here.
Morris.
Well, actually, recently, Dr. Walter had said that I want you, you should learn Corporal, right?
Right.
We talked about this a couple months ago. And the first, okay, because he wanted to see what I would do with it, because I would never, I'd never done that before. And so, yeah, I'm sort of worried, you know, like, doing it.
What was it like, by the way, like, hey, so how's the new percussion professor? Oh, it's cool, he had me take my shirt off already.
Well, I haven't gotten to that point
yet.
I haven't gotten to that, so I'll let you know when that happens. But I was familiar with the piece. I sort of knew it, but I was unfamiliar about this new sort of idiom, I guess, is how we can describe it. I think it's cool. I mean, I don't think it's really, really cool. It to me, from what I've read about the corporeal piece, it's funny, I've read about it more than I've actually looked at the piece, but it's very vulnerable. Very vulnerable. I mean, you're up there without your shirt, and it's like, I'm asking myself, can I do that? You know, can I do that? Because I don't know. It's intimidating to me. But that also makes me want to challenge myself into, can I grow to whatever that next level is?
Being
exposed like that. Like, it's a scary thing. It's not everybody can feel that way, that piece in particular. And so, is this something I want to add to my rep permanently? To be honest, I'm still on the fence about it, but I'm definitely intrigued, and I definitely want to see if I can do it. So maybe the challenge that gives new challenges, maybe new ways to think about things. I don't know, going back to the original question, it's kind of a long way to answer that.
You could maybe conceive of it as a broadening of vocabulary in a sense.
Yeah, sort of like your clinic did today. It's like we're exercising those muscles of time,
right?
You know, by doing all these crazy complex polyrhythms.
Well, I mean, touching on what you mentioned with corporeal, taking your shirt off is in many ways the least vulnerable thing about that piece. And I mean, for whatever it is, the thing that there was no piece that Steve, you know, studying with Steve for my doctorate, there really wasn't any piece that Steve said you need to do this, but corporeal was about as close as it got to that. And the reason is that every moment in that piece, you have to make a decision about what you're going to do, how you're going to do it. So even though it says sit cross-legged, hands covering your face, facing the audience, how are you going to cover your face? Like, how, you know, like, even just all the different ways you can cover your face. You can do it very, you know, and then it just goes from there. And you've got like 8 to 12 minutes of every second you having to, and so it's like forcing Michael Pratt to be Michael Pratt, because, you know, every decision you make is yours. You know, it's like, for you to go, well, I wonder what Bill Kahn would do here. It you would never almost do that in that piece, right? It's just like, how am I going to do this? And I think that's the scary thing about that piece.
Yeah.
with respect to the theatrical element that you're talking about, I think one of the amazing things about percussion in general is that there's no, you know, there's no real mystery to what we do and how we do what we do. So in other words, when an audience comes to see us play, they see Casey pick up a stick and stand in front of a marimba and will play, you know, any number of your marimba solos, which are virtuosic, but they know what you're doing. They know when you hit that note, we hear that sound. No matter how fast you do it or how you do it, there's no mystery behind how you're doing it, right? And so there's an immediate connection of, on I think a very deep level is, I could do that because I know what he's doing. So
exactly.
Maybe it's not like I can't do it as well as he can do, but I could pick up a stick and hit a marimba bar too, and it will make the exact same pitch sound that he just did, and he's like famous for doing this, right? And so there's that connection of seeing us do something, and it's like a one-to-one ratio, stick, hit, sound, you know, as opposed to a flute player where you understand they're blowing into this thing, but you don't quite, like, it just looks so complicated. Like, I don't know if I could do
vowels
that.
And
yeah, vowels and the embouchure and like getting it right through, like, you know, that's complicated. But there's nothing complicated about drumming. There's nothing complicated about what we do, right? And so that theatrical element is also then therefore ingrained in how we make that sound. You know, so they see us do that thing, and I think that's why the percussionists get the weird stuff, because we're already making these gestures and doing this, you know, doing this thing, and the same stroke that hits some bizarre sounding spring, that coil spring that has a weird sound, is the same stroke that hits a snare drum, which is a very accessible and understandable sound by anyone in drum, right? So it's like, well, they're already doing that thing, and so we'll have them do this other thing too. And I think, you know, part of that element, and then the theatrical element, it's just an extension of what we're already doing. And so a piece like Corporelle is just an extension of already what we're, why not hit that, you know? And if we're scraping something, why not scrape my face? And if we're making decisions about what stick to use and when to do it and what instrument to play it on, why not make a decision about the other thing too, about how I'm gonna cover my face. Like, we're confronted constantly, and that taps into the whole decision-making and problem-solving issue. What you're talking about with Corporelle is, I think, your uncomfortability, your discomfort with
no, I like the other word.
Uncomfortability. With decision-making. You know,
with
decision-making, because perhaps up to this time your decision-making was never in that world. Your decision making was, what mallets do I use for this thing? Or what, you know, now your decision making is a little bit like, whoa, you know, like way out of that realm. But it feeds back into the whole improvisational thing of just like this discomfort of like, I'm standing at a marimba. Every time I stand at a marimba, I know what I'm supposed to be playing because I have a piece of music and there's the notes and that's what I do. And now you're asking me to, like, for it to come from here, you know, my heart out onto that thing. It's just like, I'm just not used to that. I'm used to putting my heart into that thing on the page, but I'm not used to just like directly from my heart to the sound. And that can be really scary. It is really scary, you know?
Your comment really resonates with me, because I can remember a woodwind quintet coming into our third grade auditorium and playing, and there was an enormous mystery about what was going on. You could hear the music, but it was hard to really, these people are there sitting by themselves behind a music stand, so you couldn't even see what they were doing sometimes. And all of this activity is happening, but what's really going on? And I my perception was exactly what Morris described when the percussion ensemble played in our fourth grade assembly. So you see a motion, you hear a sound, okay, I get that. I get that right off the top. We didn't go to the same school, but we had the same experience.
Right, and I think it's the same reason why, if you're bad, I'm sure at some point in Nexus had this, your instruments are lying around, some layperson from the audience has no problem walking up to your cymbal and just like tapping it, or your drum doing this, but they would never walk up to a cello and pick it up and like play it. But it's because this kinship of like, you know, I get this thing, I can do this thing, and the cello's just like, there's no way I would ever pick up the flute and try to make a sound out of it, but I would tap the cymbal, no problem, because like, I can do that.
Yeah.
You know?
So true.
Which is why we have drums in our living room.
Yeah, so I
can tap it.
It's like having Jenga on your coffee table.
Yeah, yeah.
You have drums.
It's like
you
have finger sponges, devalue a little bit.
I had a question for Bill, if that's okay, that we talked about early on, and that's with respect to Nexus, is that are there roles that the members took on in the group? And I don't mean like, you know, this is this kind of part, and this is the person that plays this thing, and so they do like, there's some crazy hard xylophone parts, so that's like, you know, Bob's world, but it's like, this is who Bill Kahn is, therefore this is how, this is who should do this part. And maybe it is the crazy xylophone part. Like, what, how do you determine, or, you know, what are those roles? I'm just dying to know, like.
The main rule was, your role is to be yourself. And our role is to accept you as you see yourself.
How do you think they would define you in Nexus?
Read John's book.
Huh, right.
And I don't necessarily agree with it, but that's his perception. I can't disagree with it, you know. We saw each other daily, sometimes over periods of time, and we knew everything about each other, about everything there is to know. It's like being married, but without the sex.
Right.
Yeah.
You just know the person. You just know everything. You know how they, after 40 years, you know how they're going to respond. You know, you just know everything.
Right.
And then every once in a while, like Russell will do Corporel.
Right, right.
And then
tell us about that. Yeah,
Russell did Corporel in 1986 in Australia. And he laid it down, man, I'm telling you. And that was not shocking, it was just eye-opening. I thought I knew this guy. I've known Russell longer than anybody else in Nexus, longer than I've known my wife, longer than I've known anybody really that I currently associate with. And I had no idea he was capable of laying this out. And he laid it out incredibly.
Well, if that's,
and,
not, a,
from
if that's not a reason to do Corporel, my God.
Yeah.
There we go.
Well, anyway, but that thing happens, sometimes it happens with close relationships. It happens.
Right.
And it's wonderful when it happens. And it's eye-opening, and it brings you back into a state of wonder in a way.
Yeah.
So, but to answer your question, the role, we took on business roles.
Right.
I basically was the interloper, the management guy in Nexus who interacted with our management, all right? And unless Robin poked his nose into it and wanted to usurp that. And then, which happened from time to time.
Right.
Russell was responsible sometimes for arranging travel and taking care of some of the details of travel. And Bob was responsible for certain other kinds of details. I was responsible for contracting as well. So, and John was responsible for instrument care and so forth. So we had responsibilities, but still each person was always totally responsible for the instruments that they selected for a piece, and Third Construction was a perfect example of that. We never had a discussion about what someone else in the ensemble should be using. It was always, this is the instrument that I selected for this part, and everybody was in that space. As opposed to having a group discussion, well, let's match mallets, let's have this instrument, this kind of drum match that kind of drum, that kind of discussion which goes on in a percussion department because you don't have access to other instruments anyway, so, and you know the instruments that are there, but we never had that.
And
we
then,
never knew what other people
right.
were going to put, bring into the part.
And then musically, I mean, were most of the parts, you know, when, so, when you would commission somebody, I'm assuming it'd be like,
right.
this is the part I wrote for Bill, this is the part I wrote for Bob, and that took care of itself, but how would you necessarily determine something that wasn't,
well, It depends on how commissions are done. Commissions are normally done, you hire the composer goes away,
right.
And 6 months later you get something in the mail with the score.
Right.
And you've got to then assign parts.
Right.
I mean, we wouldn't work that way. We would bring the composer in, the composer would have to know us.
Right.
And they'd have to know our instruments because they're one of a kind and their pitches are one unique, their characteristics are unique. There's no way in, well, today probably you could get around that, but there's no way in the world you can get a C-sharp Balinese cymbal or a C-sharp Chinese winter gong, right?
Right.
In those days, there was no, you just stumbled upon it, it was there, and you found a way to use it in the music.
Right.
So today, however, you could probably buy one if
right.
you needed one.
Right, and I'm assuming
any of those
he's
instruments.
Like Attacovitz Concerto.
He was in Toronto.
Specifically for who?
He was in Toronto all
yeah.
the time. And then something in Casey's workshop yesterday about changing or adding what a composer wanted. Takemitsu wrote in one section for a very, very soft snare drum roll. All right.
In that concerto?
In that concerto. And as with everything in that piece, it's very exposed. And you hear it. And the guy in the last row of the balcony back there is going to hear that pianissimo, the way it's orchestrated. And Robin rightfully thought, whoa, I don't know if this is something I want to buy into. So Robin commissioned a rain stick that was about
yeah,
that
right.
long.
That's what that part is.
And that's what that part is. It was originally composed for a snare drum. And there was no discussion about that. Robin just did it, and Takemitsu was going to have to accept it. And he did, actually. He thought it was great, a great change, which composers usually do
right.
when the player takes
yeah,
that kind
yeah,
of initiative.
Yeah, yeah.
You were totally right about that.
Well, that's
so
the
there you go.
Effect he wanted, but the
exactly,
worse
right.
better.
Exactly
yeah, well,
right.
Yeah, that's what we said. That's what we said earlier.
Exactly.
Yeah, in the car, like, yeah, sometimes you know better than the composer. You know,
that's it. We live with this stuff.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah.
Did you guys have roles in your improvisations as well?
No.
No. You did those?
Well, I can talk about that a little bit. That changed over time. The first concert we did where we filled the stage and just came out and improvised, everybody was free to play anything that was on the stage. Over time, that evolved into each of us having our own little space that we use. And we started more, I should say, less and less venturing into other people's spaces during the improv. It all happened just orally in the sound that we were producing, but not physically moving around the stage. Interesting, but that's what happened. And there was never any discussion about it. It just happened naturally.
Well, maybe I'll ask you about that album, Bill, and you just sort of
so
maybe...
re-ask the question.
Because you
so
can still buy that on CD.
You
like
can.
That album exists on
right.
CD.
Right.
So people will know what that is.
What you're hearing here and on the CD, I think, is take number 10 of side one and take number 8 of side two.
Right.
But even that's, like, miraculous.
Yeah.
So, sorry, what record are we talking about, just for the listeners? Which one?
This is the Nexus Ragtime album.
Yeah.
It's
your
first
album. Isn't it your first album?
Oh, no, we had two albums before
this. Oh, did
you?
Oh.
Yeah.
Now,
Michael
Craighorn. Oh, yeah.
No, the people who don't know, this is a record that Bill just explained to us. It went from microphone straight to record, which I guess is what technology does not even exist anymore, right?
There's no need
yes.
for it today. There's no need for it today because of digital technology, you can get the same thing and have much more control over it.
But it meant you guys had to do this whole record with literally
one side,
literally
at
one
a time.
Take, one
right.
side
so
of the whole record.
We had to play on each side. How many rags are on the first side? I don't know, maybe a half a dozen or so. Yeah,
he should be wearing rubber gloves.
So you had to
there's like five. Yeah.
You had to play all six pieces in real time, including the space between the pieces, in real time, and no editing.
Yeah.
And what was played was what would end up on the record.
Cool. How's that for nervous?
Oh my god.
We're paying all this money to go into a studio. And then what I guess they would like just zero out the levels. You'd switch your music around and pick up new mounts.
Well,
and then
the dial would come down, and the producer would go. You know, he would go sort of like this, and let us know where we were in the break. We got this tent. There's going to be 5 seconds here, and he got here. Boom. We had to play.
Was this a preference of the producer?
Yes.
Was it your choice?
We were hired to do this.
Gotcha.
For the same reason, it was technology again, and the ability of percussion instruments to be recorded, and the ability, and the ability of the nuances of these instruments to be recorded well. Mm-hmm. So, and that was the whole point of it. And the geek aficionados in sound technology, of which there's a worldwide market for this kind of thing. This was a very good selling album.
Yeah, I probably found that album 25 years ago in Toronto.
Yeah, it's still out there.
In a shop in Toronto, and I was just like, man, I cannot believe I found that. And I have, there's a Canadian band called Rough Trade that did it as well, and I've got theirs, but it's the only two that I've ever...
And Anvil.
No, that's sadly, they didn't let Anvil do that. But I have to ask you about the track with Xylophonia, the duck call, the infamous duck call. How did the duck call end up on the Ragtime tune?
Yeah.
That is a crazy duck call.
Playing the duck hall, yeah.
It's like a three-horn bill.
Well, we had performed, obviously, we had performed all this music before, and the duck hall audiences always brought really good responses from audiences.
But how did it start with the duck call?
How did it start? I had a duck call, and just as I was trying to like do something really weird for the guys and freak them out and have a good laugh about it. But it happened, and we all liked it, you know? So we did it for audiences, and the audiences liked it, too. And it's a vaudeville shtick kind of thing, but it worked really well. So if you haven't heard it, you have to listen to this someday.
It's so unbelievable that this thing, that this even... And this is with your sixth member, Michael Crane, right?
With Michael.
And he lays down a great trap solo in that same tune right before your duck call solo. It's just like, how that even exists, that exists on one song alone, on a side of five others, is also just remarkable.
You'll hear more
I don't even
about
know what
Michael.
Malice he's using, because he's playing all these instruments that just work with whatever six he has in his hands.
Well, he had a little table, and there was a little old cowbell, and a little old gong here, and
Chinese tom-tom, and you hear some drums.
A tambourine, the head was broken and taped over with duct tape.
Right.
Just an outrageous, and Michael was unschooled. He never took a percussion lesson in his life. In fact, he never studied music and didn't know how to read music. And he was perhaps the biggest influence on the five of us who were like orchestra geeks at that time, because he brought a whole other openness to the approach of music making to us.
How did he get in the band?
He and John got together. John went to hear a performance in a band that Michael had called I Ching, which was a jazz band, basically a freeform jazz band. And John heard them and said, Michael, come on over to my house. And John had a room full of instruments, and anyone who ever entered John's house, it was improvising with John on these instruments within 2 minutes, you know? And so, and they improvised together, and they gelled, you know? And so, John brought Michael into the group, and we just gelled. And so what can I say about that? Everything he did, and we also noticed that in our improvisations, the things that got the best, and I shouldn't say best, but the most exciting response from the audience were Michael's licks. We all noticed that. So he was just a natural entertainer, a natural musician.
Wow.
And could reach people with whatever he was doing. Some of it was gestural too. So, he died early.
Yeah.
Well, you guys, thanks so much. This was really fun. And Morris, congrats on the Toco.
Oh, thanks.
Tiffany too, a big part of this. So yeah.
Thanks for being here. It wouldn't be wouldn't exist without you guys either. So.
Oh yeah. Sure. Cool. Okay, guys. Well, thank you very, very much. We'll catch you on the next episode.
All right.
Bye.
Thank you.